If you were to go and talk to social scientists on the question of what do voters know about politics and policy, they would actually, at first glance, not tell you anything different from what I'm telling you tonight. There's a standard consensus among anyone who has ever looked at data about what the public really knows, that the public knows almost nothing.
That's right.
Okay, so far, I'm not telling you anything controversial, but you, nevertheless, when you go and talk to political scientists who work in this area and say, well, what do voters know about politics? What do they know about policy? They'll say, well, very, very little, that's true. But they will then add, it doesn't make any difference. Which sounds very strange, right? If you were to go and quiz your surgeon before he's doing brain surgery on you, and you say, like, what's this doohickey here? And he says, I don't know. I didn't do so well in school. I don't know, all this medical school mumbo jumbo, medulla oblongata, whatever. You know, I just stick my knife in and twist it around, and hopefully it'll all work out. All right, that would be a very strange and frightening answer for your surgeon to give, and yet many people who work in social science will basically give that answer for how democracy works. They'll say, well, voters know next to nothing about what's going on, but don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. Now, this might just seem like crazy talk, but they actually do have a consistent story about how it's possible that voters' lack of knowledge won't make any difference at all. And the answer comes down to statistics. Okay, so how many people here have ever heard of something called the law of large numbers? Right. So the law of large numbers says that when you have a large number of trials, then in percentage terms, random errors will cancel out. Right. So, for example, classic case, if you go and flip a fair coin 1,000 times, the odds that you are going to be far from 50% heads is extremely small. Okay. So the idea then is, well, if we think about voters' lack of knowledge as really being a kind of random error, then basic statistics says that voters' errors will tend to cancel out, which means that the well-informed are actually in charge. The case for democracy is that most people's vote actually doesn't make any difference. All that really matters is what people who know what they're doing wind up thinking. Okay, so just to take an example, all right, now this is a highly stylized example to get my point across, but nevertheless, I will give it. So suppose that 90% of people know absolutely zero. All right, I think this is, it is fair to say this is an exaggeration. All right, so assume that 90% of people, you know, they don't know who the president is, they don't know what country they're in, they don't know what planet they're on, you know, whatever, all right? They're still standing in line to vote for some reason on an unknown planet in an unknown country for an unknown candidate. Okay, so suppose 90% of people know absolutely nothing. And just to make the example stark, let's suppose the remaining 10% of the population, they know everything. They have all of Wikipedia internalized, you know, except it's fact-checked perfectly. So, you know, their Wikipedia is already perfectly edited. So, you know, any question that might possibly be of any relevance, they know. You know, they even know the stuff that Ben Powell didn't know about Somalia. All right, so, you know, they know the population of Somalia. They know what the population was at any point. All right, so that's what these 10 percentage points of the people are like. Now, just to make the stakes interesting for this audience, let's suppose the two candidates are, first of all, candidate number one. Ron Paul is the candidate number one. All right, so in many audiences, this would be the horrible candidate to avoid, but for purposes of this audience, he could be the wonderful candidate to get. And let's see, for candidate two, let's say that it's the Unabomber. Anyone remember the Unabomber? Yes, Unabomber. How many people read his manifesto? It's very well written, actually. And in it, he says, well, look, I believe that mankind needs to return to hunting and gathering. There are those who say this will exterminate most of the human race, and they're right. Unfortunately, this is the only way for human beings to live fully human lives, and so we got to do it. Okay, so, you know, there's 80 other pages, but that is a key part in the Unabomber's manifesto is, yes, we will return to hunter-gathering existence that will exterminate almost the entire human race, but at least a few people will get to live a fully human life, unlike now when nobody does. Okay, so these are the two candidates. Now imagine that you are going and interviewing people waiting in line to vote in this election. Well, 9 times out of 10, you get these people who know absolutely zero, and you say, who are you going to vote for? They say, oh, I don't know, the Unabomber guy sounds good. And then another guy says, I don't know, maybe Ron Paul. I don't know, I'll make up my mind when I get there. All right, so that's 9 people out of 10. At this point, you may be in great worry. You say, wow, apparently about half the people favor the extermination of the human race. Or favor the candidate who will, and they're willing to vote for him despite that because they just have no idea what this guy supports. However, when one person out of 10 does impress you, one person out of 10 is actually a walking encyclopedia, and I'm assuming, which I think is fair, that none of the informed people would favor the Unabomber. Again, you know, maybe a very rare one. The Unabomber himself maybe is arguably very well informed, but still, I'll say there's effectively a zero support among them. Even most people who are not fond of Ron Paul come here to the Unabomber. They say, well, either vote for a guy who wants to legalize marijuana or a guy who wants to exterminate most of the human race. I don't know, it's close, but, you know, I mean, it's practically the same, in fact, but nevertheless. All right, so the informed people will vote for Ron Paul. Now, here's the thing. What's going to happen in this election? As long as the number of voters is reasonably large, we basically know, according to the law of large numbers, how these 90 percentage points of people are going to break down. They're going to break down with 45 percentage points for the Unabomber. So 45% of the population favors the candidate and who wants human extinction. Right, kind of scary. However, 45% vote for the guy who opposes human extinction. And then finally, when we go over to Ron Paul and the informed vote, we see 0% favor the Unabomber and 10 percentage points are going to favor Ron Paul. So when you go and add it up, Ron Paul wins with 55% of the vote. And so, whew, all right, humanity is saved. All right, everything's going to work out. All right, now you may look at this and say, is this just some kind of rigged example that I wrote down just to confuse people? The answer is no. This example illustrates a much more general principle, which is that under the assumptions I gave you, right, and under, you know, underline in your mind, under the assumptions I gave you, for a candidate to win, he must have a support of the majority of the well-informed. In fact, the candidate who has the support of the majority of the well-informed will win, again, as long as the electorate is reasonably large, we can say that with virtual certainty. Yeah, by the way, if there were three voters, you're one of them, then you should be scared, right? Because if there's three voters, you're one of them, so you know, you're voting for Ron Paul, still 25% chance that the other two guys vote for human extinction, so that they both do, and then two against one, you lose, so Unabomber's reign of terror can now begin. All right, but an election with millions of people, that is extremely unlikely. In fact, it's so unlikely, there's no point in even writing down the number of zeros that it would be under the assumptions I've given you. Okay, so what this example illustrates is that under the assumptions that we've discussed, the winning candidate will be whichever candidate has a majority of the well-informed. And this is interesting because imagine you had a world where 100% of people were well-informed. What would it take in order to win a Democratic election then? A majority of the well-informed. It turns out that you can shrink the percentage of the well-informed down to a tiny minority, and they still actually determine what happens, right, which sounds pretty good. Okay? And there is actually a name for this result in political science. They call it the miracle of aggregation. The miracle of aggregation. Right? So it's basically like medieval alchemy. You go and you pour 90% lead into a vial, put in 10% gold, you stir it around, you put a cloth over it, go say hocus pocus, pull it off, wow, 100% gold. Right? It works as if it were gold. Okay, so that is the result, and that is the, and again, call it the miracle of aggregation because it sounds miraculous. But you know, don't let the name fool you. This does logically follow from the assumptions that I've just given you. Right? So far there is no actual trickery involved. The logic is valid, as philosophers will say, meaning that they've correctly deduced the conclusion from the premise. However, as we will see, there is the question about whether the premises are correct. Now, what's nice about the miracle of aggregation from the point of political scientists, especially ones who know the data, is that this miracle of aggregation story gives them a way to believe in the facts and democracy at the same time. Like walking and chewing gum at the same time. You can believe in democracy and the facts at the same time because you can know the facts that most voters know next to nothing about what's going on in politics. You can still believe in democracy because they say, look, this is a story about how an electorate that doesn't know what it's doing, such as the one that we have, can actually give you perfectly good outcomes. Okay, so, all right, so far so good. Any questions about this? All right, yeah, just to do what Jeff says I always do, which is run my finger over the class. Any questions? No? Good. Okay. So, this brings me to the next key point, which is if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. Now, if you're like me, you stay up late at night, and every now and then you come across a commercial for starting your own alpaca farm. Anyone ever seen this commercial? So, yeah, you're watching TV at 2 in the morning, and then what do you know? You too can start your own alpaca farm. These marvelous animals who are friendly and dead and wonderful, and they have the most delightful fleece. If you just send us $2,000, we will send you an alpaca. And you just put them in your backyard, and before you know it, you're breeding alpacas. Hopefully you get one more. You're breeding the alpacas, and then you're selling alpacas to other people, and you're selling the fleece, and you're making money hand over fist as the area's alpaca baron. And all you need to do to get started is to get out of bed and call us, and we will send you your alpaca. All right. So you know, I see this ad many times, and I have never actually verified whether the ad is true. I just look at it and say, I don't believe that. I do not believe that I could successfully start my own alpaca farm. I know nothing about farming. I don't believe that what you're saying is true, that I could even put up an alfalfa farm in my backyard if I wanted to. I think there's got to be a whole, what's the catch, as the case may be. Okay, so, and this is the way that we actually get through life in many cases. We hear about wonderful offers all the time, and we say, you know, that sounds really great, and if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. Okay, so now the key assumption behind the miracle is that error is random rather than systematic. So the key assumption behind the miracle is that when a person doesn't know everything, they flip a coin to decide what to think. Okay, and you may ask, what evidence is there that this is what people who don't know very much actually do? So what evidence is there in favor of the assumption that random error is actually how it works? Right? It doesn't have to be that way. They could flip an unfair coin. They can flip a coin that always comes up heads. Person who doesn't know what he's doing could do that. Okay. Quite possible. Okay, so when I began looking into this question, this literature on the miracle of aggregation, this is an enormous literature in both economics and political science. So, literally hundreds of papers building on this assumption. So I assumed that I would be able to find some reasonably high-quality empirical work, at least trying to show this is true. And what I found out is there's almost nothing. There's almost nothing out there that actually demonstrates this. There's very little. If you go and talk to economists and say, why is it that you believe that error is random? Standard answer is, well, if errors weren't random, then people would be irrational. And you say, all right, then how do you know that people aren't irrational? Well, because to be irrational would be to go and violate our definition of rationality, and what's the definition of rationality? Is that people have random error. Right? So if you followed what I just said, it goes in a circle. Yes, well, we know that people don't make random error because that's irrational, and we know that they're not irrational because we assume that voters are rational, and we assume that voters are, what does rationality mean? It means that they don't do the very thing that we are trying to prove. Okay, so this is what I believe that most philosophers would consider this an unimpressive argument. It's actually a purely definitional point. We first define rationality in a certain way and then say, what, you're saying people aren't rational? That's crazy. Right? Well, I don't know. It seems like it might not be crazy. All right, now, anyway, this is what economists say. Now, what's more interesting to me is when you go and talk to political scientists and you say, so why do you guys believe in the miracle aggregation? And a lot of times they'll give you a deer in the headlights look and say, I believe it because economists told me it was true. You mean you're an economist and you don't believe this? You mean it isn't completely well established by overwhelming empirical research? Oh my God, my whole life is built on a lie. Okay, so political scientists will give the argument, which I'd say is even more bizarre. That's what the economist told us. All right, not very impressive. Okay, so once I realized that there really was very little actually showing this was true, then the next step is, now we've got to find some data that at least shed some light on this question. And it turns out that when you look at public opinion data, there is very strong evidence that large systematic exceptions, large systematic errors are the rule. It's not merely that this isn't always true. It's almost impossible to find a case where it's ever true. Right? So it simply doesn't turn out in areas of political interest that voter errors are actually random. And there's a number of ways that you can actually look at this question. So, see, I guess I think we'll probably have enough time. So I will quickly review three main ways, although I'm going to focus on the third way, which is the main one that I do. Okay, so if you wanted to go and see whether voter errors really were random, one would be, let's see, I guess I better erase here. All right, so method number one, this is the least controversial, although also the least interesting. This is what I call the method of objective quantitative comparison. So, for example, if you wanted to see whether the public had random errors in the public's beliefs about the percentage of the U.S. federal budget spent on foreign aid, if the errors about that were random, then what you would do two things. First, you would go and ask people, what percentage of the U.S. federal budget do you think goes to foreign aid? And step two is you would go to the actual budget and find the number. And then you would do a statistical test to see whether it is possible or at least it is in any way credible to think that the public's average answer is true. Right, so if the actual number is 1.2 percentage points, and that's about right, so 1.2% of the U.S. budget is spent on foreign aid, you can go and ask a bunch of people what they think. Then you can go and say, all right, so what is the average of the belief of the public? The average belief of the public will often turn out to be maybe 20% of the budget. So, all right, so like 15 to 20 times as big as it really is. And then you can go and do a statistical test to see whether 20% really equals 1%. Now, if you only had two observations, then the statistician might say it's still too hard to say. However, if you've got a 1,000 observations, statistics can tell you, it is really, really, really unlikely that that the public's average answer, 20%, actually reflects a population, it actually comes from a population that believes that it's 1%. Right? And you can do this for all kinds of things. You can do this for things like budget numbers, you know, anything along these lines, anything where you can just go to some standard reference work and find a numerical answer, you can go and do a survey of this kind. Right? And this has been done for a number of issues, and the public does extremely poorly. Probably some of the best studies have been done on the budget. So there's one that was done by the Kaiser Family Foundation where they just gave six items of the budget, and they say, tell me which two are the two biggest items of the budget. Okay? And the number one most common answer was foreign aid. Okay, so something that was actually about 1% of the budget was the most popular answer to this question. On the other hand, Social Security, which actually is the biggest item in the budget, came in about fifth. Okay, so in other words, I'm not going and saying, look, the public doesn't understand how much money we're spending on mohair subsidies. This is the public has very deep misconceptions, very deep, very large systematic errors about the fundamentals of what the budget is spent on. Yes, question? The public is voting for politicians who control the budget. We can talk about this a little bit more, but I mean, at least in most models of politics, the difference between voting on issues and voting on politicians is very small, because when politicians compete by saying, I believe what the American people believes about the issues, which is why when you see a debate, politicians are bending over backwards to say, I believe a bunch of popular things. I believe the children are the future. You believe that too. I believe that we should not allow our elderly to die without prescription drugs. Don't you? And then what is the candidate on the other side said? He claims to not want the elderly to die, but he's lying. He does. I'm the one who really favors the prolonged life of the elderly. Okay, so, but we can get to that shortly. But essentially, there isn't really that much fundamental difference between voting for issues and voting for people. Just like there isn't that much difference between deciding what restaurant to go to and deciding what food you're going to get. Right? You know, if people are going to restaurants that have a certain kind of food, then restaurants will offer that kind of food. Okay. All right, so method of objective quantitative comparison is one. Another method, which is common in political science, and there's a great book by a political scientist named Scott Althaus, which everything about the book is great except the title. The title is Collective Preferences in Democratic Politics, which I don't think has ever sold any books. The title has not sold any books, the content has. But anyway, if you just Google Scott Althaus's name, it's like German, Althaus, you can get the book. And the book covers a very large literature in political science known as the enlightened preference literature. All right, so, or the enlightened preference approach, I think is better to say. So, enlightened preference approach. Okay, the idea of this is that you go and you give people two kinds of questions. First of all, you go and you give them a test of objective political knowledge. This is the kind of stuff that you might get in a civics class where you say, how many senators does each state have? Name as many Supreme Court justices as you can. What year did the Civil War end? You know, all these questions where you can go to a standard reference work and you can get the answer and you can score the exam from an A to an F. All right, then the second part of this is you go and you ask them about their policy preferences. Should taxes be higher or lower? Should abortion be legal or not be legal? Should we invade Iraq? Right? So you ask them a whole bunch of questions about their policy preferences. Then finally, you want to get a lot of data about anything other than knowledge that you think might affect someone's policy preferences. So it's very common you'll get data on income, on race, gender, religion, you know, anything else that you think might make a difference. Then here's the trick of the enlightened preference literature, which if you don't have a strong background in statistics, don't worry about this. But the key idea is that you try to use statistics to make the following comparison. If we get two people who are the same in their income, same in their gender, same in their race, same in a bunch of other things, but one knows a lot more, one gets a much higher score on the political knowledge test, how would their policy preferences change? So you only compare people who are similar in every way, except some have high political knowledge, some have low political knowledge, and then you see how do their policy preferences respond, or how do their policy preferences change as their knowledge level goes up. And the idea here is that if we have control for everything else that's relevant, then we can actually say, well, it looks like greater knowledge is causing people to favor different policies. Okay, now you can do this at the level of the individual, and then the big trick is you can do this for everyone. So you can basically simulate what would happen if the entire electorate were raised up to an A+ on the objective political knowledge test, and you do get some interesting answers. Right? And these are particularly interesting because, as far as I know, Althaus has no libertarian sympathy. And yet his big punchline is that as knowledge increases, people become more libertarian. Okay, so as knowledge increases, people become more economically conservative and more socially liberal. And this is a very strong pattern. Okay, so again, I don't have time to go into all the details of how this is done, but it is a very interesting body of work, and again, totally independent of anything that I've done, so I can point to that for some further support. Now, finally, we come to the method that I actually used, which is the method of comparison between laymen and experts. So we can call this the lay-expert comparison. Okay, now, the assumption behind this approach that I use, and again, some other people have used it as well, is this. If laymen and experts disagree about something, the experts are probably correct, and the laymen are probably wrong. Now, people often get very upset about this. How can you be so elitist? Look, all right. There is a presumption. It is probably true. There are certainly cases where the experts are wrong and the laymen are right. However, it is also a case where normally you need to explain why it is that you're going with the layman rather than the expert. So when you go to a car repair shop and the guy behind the desk says, well, your car needs $7,000 worth of repairs. All right? This is a case, you say, what? That's crazy. The car is like 3 days out of warranty. Come on. And then the guy behind the desk says, look, I've been repairing cars for 30 years, sir. What do you know about cars? Well, I know that you have a very strong interest in telling me that my car is going to cost a lot of money to fix, so I'm going to somewhat discount your professional advice. And I'd say that's perfectly reasonable. However, what if you go and you meet a mechanic who knows he's not going to get your business, and he tells you the same thing? Now it starts to seem a little bit odd and paranoid for you to say, I don't know what you think. You may have a lot of experience, but in my gut tells me my car is a good car and it's going to be fine. And now it's going to go even further. Suppose that the mechanic is your son. He says, you know, Mom, the car really does need $7,000 worth of repair. It will explode. And if your mom says, what do you know? I remember changing your diapers. That's a case where I say, you know, there's something wrong with the person who says I am not going to defer to expertise in that case. All right? So basically, you know, the approach that I suggest is to go and compare the views of laymen and experts and say, look, if experts and laymen systematically disagree, I am going to presume, that doesn't mean hold a certainty, but I'm going to presume the experts are probably right, and if you don't think so, I'd like to hear some semi-plausible reason why. And hopefully it's something that we can actually test. That would also be nice. Okay. So, this method, this method, the key assumption is that if laymen and experts disagree, the experts are probably right, and the result is that there are generally very large disagreements between laymen and experts on a wide variety of questions about politics and policy. And, of course, since I'm an economist, I find it particularly interesting to look at questions, at beliefs about economics. Of course, since we're at the Foundation for Economic Education, that's another reason to talk about it. But I'd say, actually, even if you weren't an economist, and even this were not at a talk given at the Foundation for Economic Education, say that there is a very good reason to start with economics. There are actually several. So one of them is that economics is highly relevant to a very large fraction of modern policy debates. In fact, generally, if you go and survey the public and ask them what are the most important questions facing the country, questions about economics generally are their most common answer. So it's not just that economists think that economics is important. People think that economics is important. Right? So again, there were a few years after 9/11 when people said terrorism or war, but I think now we're actually back to the economy again. So economy is number one. Economy generally is number one. So basically, like all for the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, and then there's a brief break, and now again, economics is, what, according to most people, the number one area of interest that is facing the country. Okay, so that is one thing worth saying is that economics is an important subject to consider because voters consider it important, right? And of course, it does actually touch on a lot of what's going on. And now, second thing that makes it interesting to me, and I think makes for a good story, is economists have spent several centuries complaining about how awful their students are. And now, physicists, when they complain about their students, they say they're just not interested in physics. But economists don't generally say this. Economists generally don't complain the students aren't interested. Economists say the students show up and say, show up on day one of Econ 1 and say, listen to me, professor. You may think the trade with China is good, but let me tell you, they're Chinese. Let me tell you, you don't understand about the Chinese nature of the people we're dealing with. Well, you say, actually, I think I do understand that, perhaps even better than you. I just think that it doesn't make any difference. You say, no, but you don't understand, my uncle... Right, so this is the kind of thing that economists feel like we've had to deal with for a very long time, and not just recently. You can go read Adam Smith, and the frustration with the students jumps off the page. You know, I don't remember the exact quotes from Adam Smith, but it's a more genteel version of, oh my God, these students, there's what they think is so awful, and they won't listen, and it's like pulling teeth to get any sense into these kids. Erg. Okay, so, and if you were to go and try to boil down, what is it that economists have been complaining about for the last couple centuries? There's a lot of complaints, but probably the most fundamental one that economists have is that the public underestimates the social benefits of the market mechanism. And again, you may think this is just something you'll hear at FEE, but that is not true. You can go and talk to almost any normal economist, and they will give you many, many examples of cases where they think the market mechanism would be much better to use than what we're doing right now. Paul Krugman, right? Everyone knows Paul Krugman. If you want to understand labor economics and especially European labor economic policy, go and read his book, The Accidental Theorist, which blames all of European unemployment on government regulation. Right? Yes, it's a little hard to imagine Paul Krugman writing that now, but I don't think he's ever recanted. He just stopped talking about it. Okay, so, and again, I found this in general among even members of the economics profession that you may think of as very left-wing. I remember when I presented the school to a group of semi-Marxist economists, and then at dinner, I was there with the faculty and some graduate students, and I just couldn't resist. I said, all right, so what do you guys think about being able to sell your kidney for money? And a couple of the graduate students were like, oh, what about the poor? However, the Marxist professors are like, yeah, we should definitely do it. You know, Marxist professors, they're saying, or, you know, kidney selling, it may go against Marxist sentiment, but it will save 10,000 lives a year, man. And also, it will put $1,000 in the hands of poor people selling their kidneys. So wise up, Marxist students. Once you're a Marxist professor, you'll understand that kidney selling is part of any sound Marxist economic system. They're like, all right, then. I feel more at home here than I do with my dad. With you guys, we can at least talk about stuff. We can have a reasonable conversation because we can agree on some basic ideas, strange as it may seem. Okay, so this general point that the public underestimates the social benefits of the market mechanism, the public tends to think that because somebody is making money, therefore the system is bad for society, is one that has bothered economists for a very long time. Now, when you put all these patterns together, it suggests that economics as a field would be very valuable to test the public's economic beliefs for systematic error. Right? Because it's an important subject, and it's very relevant to policy, and of course, economists have been whining about it for a couple centuries. So it would be interesting to see, is all this whining justified? You know, maybe it'll turn out that it was just all out of whining for nothing. You know, maybe it'll turn out the students who show up on day one I've been reading a book saying how to aggravate your economics professor every time. And they just sit there and say, you know, they open up page 3. It's like, what about the Chinese and how they're destroying our economy? You know, maybe there's a little caddy camera that's going up on YouTube. You know, watch economists flustered by student insincerely embracing protectionism. It's possible. I have no absolute proof that this is not going on. So what I wound up doing in this book is I found a survey that was ideal for my purposes. Not only was it perfectly designed for answering the questions I was interested in, but also it was not designed by me, which meant I didn't have to do any work, and they gave it to me for free. I didn't have to raise any money. I didn't have to wait for the results to come in. And finally, of course, if someone were to go and say, and who collected this data? I can say the Kaiser Family Foundation, Harvard University Survey Project, and the Washington Post. Oh. So, yes, that's very good. So they're wonderful to me. They gave me this data for free. I was able to get many papers and this book about it. I don't know what I would have done if they had said, we refuse to share this sensitive data with you, but fortunately they did not. Okay, so this was a data set where, from the title, The Survey of Americans and Economists on the Economy, where they went and asked a very long and diverse list of questions about how the economy works to both the general public and PhD economists. And using this, you can go and actually very quickly take a look and find out, is it really true that economists and the public have exactly the same average beliefs as the miracle aggregation predicts? Right? Because the miracle aggregation predicts that since voters know less, there'll be some random error on, so there'll basically be a coin flip, which could make them too high, too low. However, the coin flip should basically balance out. Now, when you go and look at the data, it turns out that this is radically false. It's not just that I found 3 counterexamples. I found 35 out of 37 counterexamples. And so essentially, the miracle aggregation virtually never, ever works. In an entire field, field of research in both economics and political science is built upon an assumption that is not merely not always true. It's built on an assumption that is totally false, and not by a small amount, false to a very large degree. Okay, So okay, it turns out there are large belief gaps between economists and non-economists. And what's interesting is these gaps are in the very direction that Adam Smith would have predicted. Right? So it's not just the gaps exist. The gaps are in the gaps look like you would expect if economists' whining was justified. So if economists were actually listening to their students and saying, I can't believe what they're saying, this is what we wind up finding in the data. So there's basically four big biases that I see in the data. This isn't to say that if you looked at it yourself, you might not see more, or you might want to argue about the exact classification. But still, these are the four big ones that I think do jump out of the data. So the first one I've already mentioned, it's what I call anti-market bias. It's the tendency of the public to think that because people in markets are motivated by greed, and is that true? Yeah, last time I checked, there's a lot of greed. Last time I checked, people are not generally going and baking bread out of benevolence. Usually they're doing it out of their own self-interest. But again, occasionally there's someone who might do it because they just love giving bread to people, but it rarely occurs. Right? Now, again, for professors, they might say, well, I love my job so much I would do it for free. Yeah, but most people don't have jobs like that. Which is instantly a reason why all of you should try to become professors. Because then you could have a job where you say, wow, this job is so great, I would do it for free. However, you still won't have to. That's what's nice. All right, so anti-market bias, which you can see in a lot of different ways. One example that was very striking to me, I was driving down to the University of Virginia, which is about 2 hours from my house, one morning in order to deliver this talk. And now I never wake up any earlier than I have to, right? But to get down there, I had to be up at like 7 a.m. and I'm driving. And as I'm driving, I notice, wow, there's about 7 miles of cars on the other side of the road, right? So I'm driving away from D.C. I'm fine. However, there's 7 miles of cars driving that are stuck in traffic on the other side of the road. And as I'm going by, I'm saying, wow, this is a problem that every economist in the country knows how to fix. I could take it to anyone in the economics profession, and they'd say, I think we'd solve this congestion problem if we would stop letting people use the road for free. Simple solution. And this is something that would actually improve the lives of many of these people who are waiting in line for hours and hours every morning in order to go and get into D.C. And yet I was quite confident that if you were to go and propose it to the people waiting in line, they would say, what kind of a monster are you? Do you want to charge me to use a road? I should be able to use the road anytime I want. But if everyone can use the road anytime they want, then you can't really use it. And then you're sitting there stuck in traffic. So what good is it? Okay, I mentioned kidneys. There's tons of examples that you can talk about of the public's unwillingness to use markets. Just to take a much more mundane one, you can take a look at the public's views on agricultural subsidies. And first of all, as you might guess, if you talk to normal people, something like 80% of Americans favor agricultural subsidies. And if you don't ask them why, well, here's one common answer they give. We need agricultural subsidies in order to ensure an adequate supply of food. All right, so if we just relied upon self-interest, who knows whether we'd be getting food or not? So about 60% say yes, we need them to ensure an adequate supply of food. If you really want to scare them and say, oh my God, you know that there's only about 10 products that are subsidized? So who knows whether the other 20,000 products carried by the average grocery store will be there the next time you go? And yet they are. Okay, so anti-market bias is one that you can see very easily in the data. Second one is what I call anti-foreign bias. Right, so it's one thing to say that when one American buys something from another, they probably both benefit most of the time. Okay, so this is something that most Americans say, yeah, I guess. I mean, not if it's a kidney or a road, or parking or a bunch of other things. But yeah, I mean, for most things, if it's a banana, all right. But then you say, but what if the banana doesn't come from America? And then it's like, oh my God. So this is what I call anti-foreign bias, which is when foreigners enter the picture, people become especially worried that something bad is going to happen. Right? The fact that you're buying something, a toy from the Chinese, you realize the Chinese are involved here. What is this going to do? What does this mean? Could this be the end? We were to buy this stuff? Here I often think of my dad, who is a very smart guy, he's a PhD in engineering. However, I am very confident he could not explain to the slightest degree what comparative advantage is. And yet, how many times have I heard him give his two solutions for everything that ails the American economy? Solution number one, naval blockade of Japan. Or actually now it's expanded to include China and probably all of Asia just to be safe. You never know what bad is going to come out of Asia. So, and solution number two, Berlin Wall, the Mexican border. Right? And we just do these two things. He's convinced we'd be in paradise. Right? Because all the foreigners who are constantly draining the blood of this country with their toys and construction work will finally be prevented from ruining things any further. And then we will have a great country once again, like we had in the 50s. Okay? You know, back when we all drove great American cars. That even he will admit are much worse than the ones we have today, but it's another story. All right, so you can see this, of course, in trade, see this in immigration, and I'll also add, I think you can see this in foreign aid, right? Where, I mean, why is it that people think that foreign aid is this enormous fraction of the budget when it's not? I think it is when people want to go and blame someone for what's wrong with the budget, look around, they say, well, we want to blame sick people? No, sick people are nice and they need help. We want to blame the elderly? No, we love the elderly. We want to blame the children? Oh, God, no, we love the children. How about foreigners? Yes. Foreigners are sucking our budget dry. Yes, you know, how many times have I gone home to listen to my parents talk to each other about how because of illegal immigrants, all the hospitals have closed? Like, what do you mean all the hospitals have closed? Like, no, they haven't. Oh, yes, they have. There was one closed, and I saw some Mexicans there, and you know, if you just put two and two together, you'll realize. All right, so that is anti-foreign bias. A third big pattern that you see in the data is what I call make-work bias. Now, if you've read Bastiat, he has a special name for this that will only make sense to those of us who love Greek mythology, like I did in third grade. So yes, he calls the Sisyphism. If that means nothing to you, don't worry about it. The idea behind make-work bias is judging economic performance based upon employment rather than output, which again seems very natural to most people until you realize if this is what you believe, then most progress has to be stopped. Because anytime you figure out a way to get more results with fewer people, this is something that is quite likely to lead to some unemployment temporarily. And you think, gee, what would have happened if we had adopted this approach 150 years ago? When the mechanization of agriculture was beginning apace? Well, basically what would have happened is we would have saved a whole lot of jobs in agriculture, and therefore we could all have the pleasure of being farmers today. Right. So basically what happened was that we, rather than saying look, we need to save jobs in agriculture, we allowed agriculture workers to be unemployed by progress. And what did farmers wind up doing? They wind up building modern civilization. They wind up doing everything else. And yet at the time, of course, if someone had said, yes, Mr. Smarty Pants economist, tell me specifically what farmers are going to do. I don't think any economist could have said, oh, they'll invent an internet of some kind or cure cancer or disease that was like virtually unknown because no one lived long enough to get it. You'd give a list of all the things people might be doing. It would have been, you couldn't have done it. All you'd say is, well, there's something or other. And it's labor's valuable. People find something to do. It would have been radically unconvincing at the time, and yet it turned out that answer is it was entirely true then and is entirely true now. And even 40 years ago, if you were to say that jobs in manufacturing are going to stop expanding, the population's going to get a lot bigger, someone would say, well, what are people going to do other than manufacturing? I don't know, something. And you know what? That I don't know answer had a lot of wisdom. something. It turned out to be something. Right, it wasn't. That's what we got. And of course, if you knew what it was going to be, then you probably wouldn't have been answering someone's dumb questions. You probably would have been investing in the internet to get in on the first floor. But okay, so and then this make-work bias you often see in policy, especially in European countries where they have a lot of regulations to make it almost impossible to fire anybody. People think of this as a wonderful thing, and yet it is also means that you wind up greatly retarding progress. And on top of that, there's other things such as when employers know that it is almost impossible to get rid of a worker once you hire him, they take the radical, horrible, greedy measure of not hiring people in the first place. As even Paul Krugman will happily tell you. Or not happily, as Paul Krugman will reluctantly tell you when the cameras are off now. All right, and a last big bias that you see in the data is what I call pessimistic bias. This is this tendency of the public to think that the American economy is going to hell in a handbasket, that we have been in decline for decades, that things are really bad right now, and that things are going to be even worse in the future. Right? A very commonly held view, right? And again, one that economists generally say, what are you talking about? Like our unemployment rate now when things are bad is like way better than it was 20 years ago when things were considered good. And we have all these things that people didn't have 20 years ago, so like compared to what? Maybe compared to like 6 months ago, things are bad now. All right, how about compared to what is normal throughout human history? Are things bad that way now? No, things are actually incredible right now. You know, if you could go and take a time machine back 100 years to escape the subprime crisis, you would be a fool to do so. So you go back, you say, isn't it great to be in an economy without any subprime crisis? And then you look at the Sears catalog, you say, all right, now, where's my internet access? You know, where's my electricity? Where is my running water? You know, oh, no. I say, oh, my God, you know, the subprime crisis wasn't really that bad. In fact, it didn't affect me at all. And, you know, other than through reading the newspaper and hearing stories about it happening to somebody else. Okay. All right. Now, when you look at this, you may remember that I said that I only have a presumption that when laymen and experts disagree, that the laymen are wrong and the experts are right. So I'm putting these up as biases, but you may say I'm jumping the gun. Isn't it possible that it's really the experts who are wrong and the laymen who are right? And again, I don't deny that it's possible. And here I often think of a book that's called, the Encyclopedia of, what was it called again? It's like the Encyclopedia of Expert Misinformation, something like that. And it's just a big dictionary on a bunch of topics of famous experts saying things that are stupid. Okay, so, and it's fun to read. It is, like, if not laugh out loud funny, it's at least chuckle-worthy. However, notice that there is no dictionary of amateur misinformation. We don't go and put out a book of all the stupid things that Uncle Bob said about physics. Because that's not funny. For a normal person to say something stupid is expected. When an expert does it, it's funny. Which suggests that it is at least more, it is less normal for an expert to say something stupid than it is for laymen. Okay. So couldn't it be the experts who are biased? It's entirely possible. I'm wholly open to this possibility. And if you go and listen to people, there are basically two stories that people will tell. And it is interesting, if you're in an area like physics or logic, there's very few people who devote their lives to physics are liars in the pay of, you know, of evil millionaires, or logicians are serving the interests of the rich. But when you go and look at people who aren't happy about economics, you will get a lot of statements to this effect. Okay, so basically the two main stories you get about why economists are evil people who are not to be trusted, one can be called self-serving bias. This says, look, economists have high income. True. Another reason to become an economist. Economists have tenure. True for many, but not all. Economists are, and then they'll go on, economists are mostly male, they're mostly white, they're mostly over the age of 40. You know, you can go and list a bunch of characteristics. And maybe it's possible the reason why they think these things is because they basically think things that are in the interest of people who fit their particular profile. So basically, maybe economists favor policies that are good for the rich, or people who are rich and have a lot of job security. Okay, so that is possible. However, there is a simple way to statistically test for this, and intuitively what you're trying to do is the following test. If you go and compare an economist who's rich and has a lot of job security to a non-economist who's rich and has a lot of job security, will they agree? If you go and take, say, my dad, who has a high income and also now he's retired, so he has full job security in that sense, and you go and compare him to me, will we agree on the basis of income and job security alone? Or will it turn out that when you go and compare an economist and non-economist who have the same income, same job security, and so on, will they actually still have a normal level of disagreement? Okay, so as you might guess, the answer to this is you can go and make this try to compare apples and apples, try to compare economists to non-economists who have a similar situation in life, and the punchline is almost all of the belief gap remains. And basically, at an absolute maximum, you can make about 20% of a very large belief gap go away, which means that 80% remains after throwing in the kitchen sink. Once you try to put in every possible control variable that you might think of, and there are a lot in this data set, it still turns out that there's a massive gap between economists and the public. The punchline is that rich non-economists with a lot of job security basically think like normal people. Now, on the other hand, if you could go and find the low-paid economist who thinks he's not going to get tenure, he will still generally think things that are typical of a normal economist. So the self-serving bias story just doesn't seem to work. Now, another common story that people tell is what I call the ideological bias story. This says, look, economists are a bunch of extreme right-wingers. It's a cult, and the only people who go into the cult are people who are extremely right-wing. Okay, so now, if you hang around George Mason, you might actually be forgiven for believing this. But if you go to the American Economic Association meetings, you will learn the deep, dark truth, which is that the typical economist is a moderate Democrat. He is a moderate Democrat who thinks that downsizing is good for the economy, that supply and demand determines the price of gas, that we should legalize kidney sales, on and on. He is a moderate Democrat who thinks a bunch of things that will horrify his fellow partisans, but nevertheless, he still says, well, I share the values of these people. It's just when I learned something in economics I realized perhaps the best way to save the poor is not by killing 10,000 people a year, by banning the kidney market. Just saying. Okay, so anyway, if you know anything about economists, you know this ideological bias story is probably not going to work. It actually turns out that when you go and try to compare, say, a politically independent, ideologically moderate economist to a politically independent, non-ideological non-economist, actually the gap gets a little bit bigger. Precisely because since the typical economist is a moderate Democrat, they are a little bit left of center. And for a left of center person to think that downsizing is good is really weird. Right? Which means that the effect of economic training is even bigger than it initially appears. Okay. So bottom line, both theories about why economists are not to be trusted, self-serving bias and ideological bias, fail very basic statistical tests. So, self-interest explains at most 20% of the belief gap, and even that's an exaggeration for reasons we could talk about in the Q&A. And ideological bias explains less than zero of the gap, which means the gap gets bigger when you adjust for it. Okay. So, any questions about this? Sort of like big questions, say, for the end, but I'll take some sort of clarification questions right now. Okay, so, questions, good, no, all right, move on. Yes. All right, so we can have plenty of questions at the end. All right, so far so good, but now there is something that I know about economists, and that is economists are notoriously people who, once you tell them that something is true in fact, so they're saying, yeah, but how is that possible in theory? So maybe it is true in fact that people suffer from all these, but isn't that theoretically impossible? Now, it's easy to laugh at this, but it's not as crazy as it seems. You know, if you were to go and tell a physicist, I saw a helium balloon floating over the sky, doesn't physics say that's impossible? You might say, well, it seems like it's impossible, but is there some possible way we could reconcile basic physics with helium balloons at the circus? Maybe. Okay. So, and actually, this is what I'm going to do here. Right? So, there is a standard story among economists that they will often tell you, and especially if you hang out in public choice. Very often when you go and point all this out, they say, oh, we got a great story for that. It's called rational ignorance. Rational ignorance. And once again, I think I'm going to have to erase something. Let's see, what can I erase? I'll erase this. Okay. So I'll tell you the story is rational ignorance. People don't understand this stuff because it just doesn't pay for them to learn it, because you can get through life just fine without knowing this stuff. And so far, so good. I know my dad has gotten through life very well without knowing any of this stuff. Right? So, yes, he's been successful in business, runs a business on eBay. He just doesn't need to understand why trading with the Chinese is mutually beneficial in order to run a used car parts business. I am sure that if someone in China wanted to bet his parts, he would not sit there saying, yeah, but trading with China is dangerous. What if they got their hands on some of these 1940 Ford parts, and then with their crafty, wily ways, they would do something or other. And step one, get 40 Ford parts. Step two, step three, destroy America. All right, so anyway, rational ignorance is the standard story that economists tell, but it actually has very severe problems. Problem number one, which, again, if you're not an economist, you won't care about this, but if you are, you should, and that is the way that most economists model and define ignorance, it is not consistent. Rational ignorance is not consistent with systematic error. The way that economists think about rational ignorance is that you should add on a big coin flip. So rational ignorance, just the way that it's standardly written in an economics journal article, to say that someone is ignorant just means that we have an especially large positive or negative error, but still the standard assumption is that those errors balance each other out. So normally the way that economists model ignorance, they still rule out systematic error by assumption. Okay, so this means that at least if we're talking to economists, there's something wrong with that story, because at least as we usually model ignorance, rational ignorance is not consistent with systematic error. Now, if you're not an economist, you may care, well, who cares how economists define ignorance or how they model it? But here I'll say, make some more general points. So one of them is the idea of rational ignorance. It doesn't explain why the uninformed have strong opinions instead of being agnostic. Okay, so for example, take the history of ancient Sumeria. Anyone know anything about this? Yes. Yes, Rod Long does. Does anyone other than Rod Long have any strong opinions about ancient Sumeria and its structure? Is anyone there saying it was a matriarchy run by a council of wizards? Okay. Probably not. And if you met a person who had actually studied it, say Rod Long, and he told you, actually, it was a patriarchy and no wizards were involved in the government, you probably wouldn't say, you liar, you're saying this in order to mislead the masses for your own nefarious purposes. Okay. And yet, when you go and look at areas like economics, people who know next to nothing about the subject generally have strong opinions anyway. It isn't that someone who's never studied economics says free trade, protection, who knows. It's a standard pattern. Someone who's never studied economics is very likely to be a protectionist and will almost never be a free trader. People who know nothing about the subject gravitate towards one particular view. And it's not just that they say, I don't know, seems like protectionism is a good idea. People who know nothing about the subject, who couldn't tell you what the textbook says, will often get very worked up about it and say, it's definitely the case, don't you understand? I saw it on Lou Dobbs. And Lou Dobbs again, yeah, so what does he know about it? But so knows that it gets ratings to go and denounce it, I think. Okay, so it would seem that the rational thing to do if you've never studied a subject is generally to be agnostic, to have moderate views weakly held, and yet, strangely, there are many subjects, you know, not just economics, politics in general, religion, you can tell some areas of science, where people who know next to nothing generally have strong opinions anyway, which is weird, very weird. All right? Now, a second thing that rational ignorance doesn't explain is why do people get so emotional about the issues? Why is it that someone who knows very little about a subject gets all worked up over it? Why is it that you can go and read blogs and see exclamation points of all kinds and denunciations and attacks on people who think differently? And why is it that you can say something, however politely, and have people assail you as the Antichrist? This is kind of weird, right? You know, if you were to go to someone and say, I think your mechanic is wrong about the problem with your car, I think it's actually a problem with your ignition, not a problem with your exhaust system. I don't think people are likely to say, you monster, you're trying to destroy my car by allowing me to keep a non-functional exhaust system on it. I think people would normally say, really? How do you know that? That's interesting. It'd be good to know why my car is broken. However, if you go and start arguing with someone's core political views, or often even very minor political views, like Jeff Hummel's going to talk about 100% reserve versus fractional reserve banking, where I've seen people get so worked up over the subject, it's almost impossible to imagine if you haven't been there. And yet, there's people like, you are Satan. The 100% reserve banking is the only ethical system. Anything else is theft, and you, sir, are a thief. Or a defender of thieves, which is worse than being a thief, because you provide the intellectual underpinnings for thievery. Your fault, Jeff. Jeff personally is to blame. Okay, so it would seem strange if someone were merely ignorant that they would get so emotional about the issues, and yet politics and economics are fields that are notorious for people getting all worked up. And if you don't believe me, I suggest that you just go to a political meeting of any group that you disagree with, and with a big smile on your face and a polite spirit in your heart, just go and start saying at the Young Republicans meetings, but, I mean, I don't know, is it possible that Americans provoked them or something? I don't know. I don't know. I'm just curious. What do you? I think that you will not be given actually, it's impossible for the following three reasons. And if you go through the history, instead, I think that you are going to get a lot of ugly looks. And people are going to be very upset with you. And again, of course, it helps to be polite, but politeness will not save you. Right? You will not, as a rule, make friends by going to a group of people who think something very different from you and trying to, in the friendliest possible way, say they're completely wrong. Right? And you might think they'd be grateful. They say, look, it's a new source of information. Isn't it wonderful that someone comes along to help us strengthen our arguments? Isn't it great that we're no longer just talking to ourselves any longer? But no, not a normal reaction. Now, an example of this that is very strongly in my mind is, you know, the case of the tariff, how do non-economists really react? So if you believe the rational ignorance story, if you go and say, hey, Clinton in 1996 passed a tariff against Mexican oranges. Well, if someone's rationally ignorant, I think the reaction would be like, really? We passed a tariff on Mexican oranges? Or, I didn't realize that Mexico produced oranges. Or, what's a tariff? All right, so if it were just a matter of ignorance, that would be the kind of reaction you should get. And yet I know from experience that if you go and mention this subject to most people, you won't get that reaction. Instead, you get a reaction of, it's about time we finally got tough with the Mexicans. Their oranges were destroying our country. The only question is, can America still come back from the brink? That is a much more common reaction. Those Mexican oranges were destroying our country. So how many oranges were coming in here anyway? The important thing is they were destroying our country. Don't you understand? Yes, again, this is based in part upon conversations with my dad. All right, so if rational ignorance doesn't really fit many of the key facts about political thinking, then what can we say? Well, I've got another story, which is similar in some ways but different in others. I call this story Rational Irrationality. And here's the idea, or really the question that inspires it, which is, why would people be rational some of the time and irrational at other times? Because, you know, there are many areas where my dad is actually extremely rational. He's very good at running a business. If I had a problem with my car, I would go to him. And actually, out of all the people I know, if I needed to actually have someone to keep me alive on a desert island, he might actually have to be my first choice. Because I have a lot of friends who I enjoy talking to more, but I don't think they could keep me alive. My dad is a very practical guy. I think he could do it. Okay, so he's, in some ways, he's an extremely rational guy. On the other hand, there's a number of subjects where his views are completely ridiculous, and there's just no arguing with him. So, what's going on? Well, my answer is this. We can actually think about irrationality as being a good like any other. Think about irrationality as being a good like any other, where we can actually go and draw a demand curve for this good. Okay. So, all right, so we can go and put a usual supply and demand curve, or your usual axes, where you have a quantity here, price here, except this is going to be a quantity of irrationality, and this is going to be a price of irrationality. I'm suggesting that we can go and we can put a normal demand curve here. Remember, demand curves slope downwards, which means that as the price gets higher, people are consuming less. Okay? Now, if you're wondering, what does it even mean to be, quantity of irrationality? This is, a degree of deviation from what a rational person would do. And a price, of course, isn't like the price you pay at a grocery store. It is, you think about it, the price in terms of how much material wealth you're giving up for a given unit of irrationality. Okay? Now, when you think about it this way, you can say two things. First of all, there are some beliefs where being irrational is extremely costly. Right? Some beliefs where being irrational is extremely costly. For example, suppose you're a surgeon and you believe that you're such a great surgeon that you can operate on people perfectly well while you're drunk. All right? Well, that is a belief that is very costly to hold. It's gratifying to the ego, yes, and I know surgeons are supposed to have very big egos, but still, you won't be a surgeon for very long if you hold this. You're going to get sued to death. You're going to lose your license. You're going to ruin your life. So this is something, a case where a bit of humility is worth the price. All right, so I'm not that good. How are you? When I'm sober, I'm the best, but drunk, I might possibly not be the best. Right? Or similarly, the belief that you can fly, right? Was anyone ever, when you were a kid, you ever put on a towel around your back, your cape, and your Superman, and then, I can fly, right? But how many kids will actually go and jump off a roof saying, I can fly, yay. Yes. Every now and then, yes. I've heard of a couple people do, but it's unusual. It is unusual. And out of for adults, it's really very rare. For adults. Yes, yes. And here's what I'll say. If you believe that you can fly, you will not believe it for very long. So... All right, so for some beliefs, errors and irrationality, the failure to take full advantage of the information you have, is extremely costly. In some cases, getting all worked up at someone and calling them evil because they tell you, no, I don't think you can really fly. Like, you're trying to hold me back from my destiny as Superman. All right, that is not an overreaction. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right, Dad. Maybe I can't fly. On the other hand, though, this is not true for many beliefs. There are many beliefs where you could be completely wrong about them for your entire life and nothing will ever happen to you. For example, you could spend your entire life believing that it would be terrible for there to be a market in human kidneys, and the odds this will actually make any difference in your life is very small. You say, well, what if you need a kidney? Well, here's the thing. Do you personally determine kidney policy in this country? I don't think so. Is the kidney czar here? If so, legalize the sale of kidneys. You're killing people. But in any case, this is something. The key thing is that for any political decision, in general, it is the case that if you change your mind, policy will not change. It's sad but true, right? So in general, if you change your mind about the political question, this will not generally change what policies exist, which means that the actual cost to you of having crazy views about policy is really extremely small. Essentially, unless your belief is going to flip policy one way or the other, then it is really very safe. Here I often think, you may have heard about when World War I broke out, crowds all over Europe broke out to cheer, and people are saying we'll be out of the trenches before Christmas, because everyone knows the Germans can't fight. Stuff like this. Right? And something where, again, it's a very, very pleasant belief, but suppose you were someone who sat around saying, I don't know, Germans seem pretty tough to me, seem pretty determined. Well, if you were to say that, that would not have ended the war. And in fact, you would probably have faced some very severe social sanctions of people saying, how can you say that? You're a traitor. And it's like, how am I a traitor to say this could last forever and kill millions of people? I don't see how that's treason. But people would call you a traitor nonetheless, and a coward too. Yes. All right. So there are many beliefs where rationality is privately very costless. So what practical difference does it make if you don't believe in comparative advantage, if you don't believe in evolution? You can disbelieve in a lot of things that are very well established, and yet, if you pick the right things to disbelieve, you can still live a perfectly safe life. All right? So now many economists say, well, why is it that anyone wants to be irrational? Why does anyone want this so-called good of irrationality? Well, here's what I would say. If you're a rational person, then every day you are betting your entire worldview. Every day you have to be open to the fact that some new evidence might come along or some new argument that shows that you are wrong. And is it fun to be wrong? Well, in general, it is. People don't consider being wrong to be very fun. There's a very interesting book called The God That Failed. It's a bunch of autobiographies of former communists. Not one of them said, it was so great to learn that communism was false because then I got to be right after that. Every single one of them said, it was the most horrible thing in my life to have to give up communism. It gave my whole life meaning. And after that, my wine tasted bad, and the food was bad, and I lost all my friends, and I wanted to kill myself. Those are the kinds of things that ex-communists generally said. And I think that they are really quite normal. If someone gives up their political view, gives up their religion, normally it is very crushing to their sense of self. And if you don't want that to ever happen to you, then irrationality is a bulletproof vest to prevent you from ever having to change your mind. As long as you are a totally irrational person, as long as you just say, look, whatever I feel is true, it's got to be true. Because otherwise, my emotions would be wrong. it's true anyway, and my gut tells me it's right. So rationality is a great way to protect your beliefs, which first of all means that you can protect your ego, and many people's ego is very fragile. And then on top of this, there's also the social sanctions. If you were to go to all your friends, say the friends you've made here, and at the end you say, you know what? I think all this stuff you're talking about is complete nonsense, and I've got 17 arguments why. I don't think you would have many friends at the end of it. Again, maybe you've got some friends who've known you for a long time, and they say, I respect his integrity so much and his intellectual honesty. There's a lot of people, though, who go, sell out, traitor. Yeah, I've seen it happen. Yes. Yes. Now, of course, Ed has the grace to call me a sellout and a traitor, but to remain my friend. So, yes, 2 points for Ed. Very good. But many people do not have that kind of grace. All right. Okay. So I think rationality may seem like a strange good, but it's actually one that if you think about the way that real people are, and think about actual human psychology, it really does make a lot of sense that people would want this good, again, not as an end in itself, but as a means of protecting them from the slings and arrows of the world, right? And from protecting them from reality. If you don't ever want to be mugged by reality, just avoid reality and you will be safe. Okay? But again, make sure you do it on questions where the cost of being wrong is very small. Because if you avoid reality on the question of can you operate well while drunk, or if you can fly if you just put a cape on, then you may actually wind up paying a severe price. All right. Now, what's interesting about it when you think about things in this way is that political irrationality doesn't turn out to be just one weird exception. So economists don't have to say, well, people are rational about everything except politics, and politics is weird. Or that can be true, but that seems strange. What I'm saying is actually politics is part of a big family of areas where if you are wrong, the consequences are really very small. That includes not just politics, it includes religion, philosophy, a lot of science. All these areas where someone could safely neglect a world of data and nothing's ever really going to happen to them. Okay. So Ed actually was complaining about talking about efficiency, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. So when you present this to economists, they'll often say, well, all right, maybe all this is right, but what's inefficient about it? Maybe we've just misunderstood the point of democracy. Maybe we have falsely assumed the point of democracy is to adopt policies that increase wealth and prosperity. Maybe the real point of democracy is to give the entire country some therapy. Maybe the real point of it is basically it's like a big group therapy session where we all get together and we all talk a lot of nonsense to each other and we all feel good about ourselves. And the fact that we go and adopt a bunch of policies that are stupid and kill 10,000 people who need kidney transplants every year, that's worth the price because I would rather have a small chance of dying from a lack of an available kidney than have to feel bad about myself every day. I have to look myself in the mirror and feel there's a guy who doesn't have all the answers. All right, so possibly, however, I do have a very standard economic story for why this actually is inefficient, and it's this. I'm not sure if anyone had talked about externalities or public goods earlier this week. Did anyone do that? Right. Well, there's a general point in economics about how when there's a big difference between the private cost of something and the social cost of something, you generally get too much of it. That is, you get an inefficiently large quantity. So, for example, if you're driving a car that pollutes heavily, and an environmentalist comes up to you and says, "You fool, don't you understand that by driving that car, you are poisoning yourself?" What would you say if you were a perfectly selfish person? Is what he's saying literally false? Well, it's not literally false because you are poisoning yourself a little bit. But here's the thing. How much are you poisoning yourself? How much difference does your driving make to the quality of the air that you breathe? Virtually none. Right? Virtually none. And if you steam up your car, how much effect does this have on the convenience of your life? A lot. So this is the case where an individual who drives a very polluting car bears only a very small part of the cost of what he's doing, but on the other hand, he gets a very large amount of the benefit. And so it actually turns out to be in an individual self-interest to drive a polluting car. Okay? Again, you can go and talk about whether this can be changed, but still, standard economic point, when you go and look at a city where people are choking to death in pollution, it is entirely possible that this pollution is actually at an inefficiently high level, but individuals are not considering what is in the interest of everyone. They're only considering their own interests. So basically, if you were to go and multiply those costs by the cost that an individual pays by the millions of people have to breathe the worse air, then it might come up to a very large amount. Right? But in general, people don't plan their lives based upon what would be good for the world, and they normally plan it based upon what would be good for themselves. Okay? All right. So it is a very standard story that if people are doing something where they get most of the benefit and society bears most of the cost, they will produce an inefficiently large quantity of it. Well, what can we say about irrationality? Well, if one more person believes that protectionism is the path to prosperity, what effect does that generally have upon how protectionist policy is? Assuming this person is just a normal guy, it's not the president or something like that, but it's just a normal person. One person becomes a protectionist from watching Lou Dobbs. What is the effect upon the tariff rate the next day? Generally, approximately zero. Okay. So the individual, he goes and watches Lou Dobbs, he gets all fired up, he realizes that the Chinese and Mexicans are responsible for all the problems in his life. The Chinese and Mexicans are the reason why his wife left him and he's unemployed. And he's now got a scapegoat from watching Lou Dobbs, and he feels a bit better about himself. And what happens to policy? Nothing. However, if we have many, many millions of guys who watch Lou Dobbs and think this, what is the consequence of this likely to be for policy? Well, when politicians find out the public opinion has shifted substantially in the direction of protectionism, how are politicians likely to change the platforms they are offering to the public? They are likely to make them more protectionist. Right, again, for the obvious reason that politicians want you to like them. And what is a good way to make people like you? Tell them the opposite of what they think? No, you tell them what they want to hear. That is a standard technique for how to make people like you from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. You tell people what they want to hear. You don't go and tell people, I know that you're a Baha'i, but actually I believe that the Baha'i truth, the Baha'i religion is the falsest of all religions, and here's why. Right? And let's go to the archaeology. Let's start with the archaeology. I have a 10-point lecture planned for you. All right, that is generally not a good way to become the friend of the Baha'i. Even if you only had one area where you disagreed, you would be well advised to say, I've heard the Baha'is believe in the brotherhood of all men. That sounds good. Let's talk about that. Or, of course, if you were not an honest person, then you might say, I hear you believe in the following 70 things, and I agree with all of them. They're all great. That's what you do if you're running for the president of the Baha'i Baha'i community, and you're not one yourself, but you still say it anyway, because that is what you need to say in order to make them like you. And if they don't like you, then they're going to vote for the other guy. Okay. So the private cost of voter rationality is basically zero. An individual who has irrational views about economics, politics, environmental policy, anything else, basically pays none of the cost. However, the social cost can easily be enormous. One of my favorite examples is a Nazi slogan in 1932 when they were campaigning to become the government of Germany. And one of their slogans was, National Socialism means peace. Right? So they ran on that slogan, National Socialism means peace. All right, now, if you were someone who saw the slogan and you read Mein Kampf, you said, no, they don't seem consistent. Mein Kampf is all about how we're going to attack a bunch of countries, but their slogan is National Socialism means peace. Well, you might, in terms of the private cost of saying, I don't think this, turns out actually the private cost of doubting this is actually probably positive in the sense that if you were someone who actually went around criticizing Nazi policies, bad things would wind up happening to you. So actually this is a case where believing something was false was actually better for you in selfish terms than believing something was true. And if you were to go and say and express your doubt, what are the odds that you personally could have swung the election? Unfortunately, quite slim. Okay, so what I like to say then is that voter irrationality is political pollution. Right? When people have irrational views about politics, it is basically like taking and throwing a whole bunch of goop in the air. Right? It's like, so here's all these horrible views, I think, and I'm going to throw them into the common pool and let them pollute the pool, the pool of social belief, and then we're all going to get our glasses and drink whatever junk people put in. And that's what democracy is. Everyone goes and puts whatever stupid beliefs they have into the common pool, and then they say, all right, well, that's what we got to drink. And that's what... Say, ew, yuck. Say, well, but that's democracy for you. And yes, yes, it is. Okay, so since I think many of you are likely to one day become active researchers who are working in this area, I will close by saying, well, so if so much of political economy is wrong, and there's hundreds of papers that are built on the miracle aggregation, and there's no evidence in its favor, and it's not just slightly wrong, it's totally wrong, so what next for political economy? Well, what I'm going to say is we need some major changes. We need to scrap the rational voter model. Anytime someone sits around and says, we have to explain the world of politics on the assumption that whatever exists is in the interest of most people. No, stop doing that. Never again. We are never again going to presume that whatever exists is in the interest of most people and then try to explain why whatever policy, however bad, is actually good. So people in economics and political science must stop doing that. Now, it must stop. No more. Secondly, this does not mean that we need to throw out all the work that's been done. The next step is to salvage valuable empirics, and there is a lot of very valuable empirical work out there that has been abused by people who are trying to make the facts fit the theory. Okay, so, for example, you can go over to people in political science who work in public opinion. There are many amazing facts in public opinion that are well established, and there's no reason to throw those out. Right, that is based upon actual observation. My claim, though, is that when you look at public opinion through the lens of rational rationality, you get a very different view of the facts than when you look at through the lens of the rational choice model or the rational voter model. When you look at through the lens of the rational voter model, you're thinking, gee, this has to make sense, but how? And when you're looking at through the lens of rational rationality, you're saying, oh, once again, people turn out to have crazy views. Is there any way that they're not crazy? I don't know. Anything? I don't think so. All right, moving right along. Okay. So, scrap the rational voter model, salvage the valuable empirics, and then, and this is I'm offering a full employment act for economists and political scientists who work in this area. Next, rebuild. Hundreds of papers can now be disregarded and ignored, and put down the memory hole. An entire new field is now ready to be rewritten on the foundations that I've offered you today. So I will stop there. Thank you very much. And now I think we got 15 minutes for questions. I guess Rod had his hand up first. Can you speak up, Rod, a little bit?
I think that in addition to the factor of whether the ignorance or irrationality is costly or not, mm-hmm. you might also want to consider whether it's the kind of belief that tends to be the ego or not. The reason I say that mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, that's not their area where ignorance is mm-hmm. costly for
yes.
people. But it's also an area where most people don't have much of a mm-hmm. worldview, and their ego is mm-hmm. bound up with the highest whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. So I talked about that in the book, but I didn't get to it in the lecture. So as far as I know, there's very few people who have like very bizarre theories about oceanography. It's just not a subject that people feel all that emotional about. So yeah, I mean, so it's possible that the demand curve for rationality looks like this, where it's just a question that is so dry and boring that no one has an opinion about it and doesn't feed the ego, in which case the miracle aggregation may very well work. So if you read James Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds, there he talks about a contest to guess the weight of an ox. Last time I checked, there was no cult of saying, oxes weigh 4 tons. It just isn't the kind of thing that really appeals to people. But very often you're going to find very strange groups will have strange doctrines about things that you might think no one would care about. Again, like 100% reserve banking. Who would have ever guessed that there would be a group of people who would sit there at night going, there are people who don't believe in 100% reserve banking, and I can't sleep knowing that these people exist. Okay, you do need to do some empirics about what it is that might gratify the ego, but yes, so you're absolutely right, Rod. Yes?
What do you think of Robin Hanson's idea of a future market mm-hmm. and how that would be a better predictor?
Yes, prediction markets are fantastic, and I think my theory is uniquely poised to explain why they would work so well and why they do work so well. slight exaggeration, but you think about prediction markets is that you actually make people put their money where their mouths are. You make them bet on their beliefs. And this has a number of interesting effects. One is that a whole bunch of people who are really loud and strident won't bet anything, ever, no matter what the odds are. You say, that's interesting. Why not? You know, how many? And when you really start thinking about this, I think it is useful, and you'll make some enemies doing this, but do it anyway. And that is when pompous people go around saying it is absolutely sure that Hillary will win the election or whatever. That is the time when it is up to you to say, if you're absolutely sure, you should be happy to bet me at 1,000 to 1. Because if it's absolutely sure that 1,000 to 1, you're still taking my money for nothing. So let's bet. Let's sign. Okay. In my experience, no one will take these bets. Which I think is a nice case of when you raise the price of being irrational, suddenly people realize, actually I was saying a bunch of things that aren't true, and I know they're true, and it was pleasant to say it, but when you really put it that way, it's more like, I want you to give me 2-to-1 odds. Really? Very, very interesting. Yes. Now, if you read my blog, one of my favorite things to do is when I find someone saying something that just seems ridiculous. Very often the ridiculous thing isn't that the prediction is ridiculous, but the certainty with which they hold it is ridiculous. Like Mark Stein, that was mentioned yesterday, in his book he claims that it's nearly certain that the EU will break up in the next 10 years. Now, I'm not a big fan of the EU, but still, when I hear that, I say, that's ridiculous. It's not nearly certain. It's not even 50-50, right? So I offered to publicly bet him, and somehow he actually found out, and he did agree to the bet. So I think in 10 years, something like that, so he's going to owe me $100, in all likelihood. Again, now, I don't say that I'm certain that he's wrong. I think he's 80% chance that he's wrong. But again, I've also found that it's usually useless holding out for odds because people just will not bet you. Will not bet you for odds even after they have made their ridiculous, pompous claims about how any fool can see whatever it is that I'm saying. So anyway, with prediction markets, one great thing is that it greatly raises the price of being irrational, which causes many people to shut up. And that's wonderful. And secondly, there's also a very nice evolutionary effect, which is that people who are in general accurate win bets. And this means they have more money, and it means they wind up becoming bigger players in the market. On the other hand, people consistently lose bets. Eventually, even if they won't shut up, they just don't have much money left to bet with. Okay, so betting markets, give a very accurate prediction of what's going on, and that is why when someone can point to a betting market showing something, normally I will say, I'm willing to defer to that betting market. Right? So big fan of Julian Simon, but when betting markets say that that on December 31st, 2016, the price of oil will be $140 a barrel, I say, well, I think I pretty much have to accept that unless I'm willing to bet some money on that. Now, no, that's not nearly as bad as it might seem because there's going to be 8.5 years of inflation. So this means that the nominal price of oil is not predicted to decline, but the real price will decline. So Julian Simon is still vindicated in the end, but still not as much as I would have thought. But again, by the way, everyone knows about the Julian Simon Paul Ehrlich bet. One of the great early cases of prediction markets where, yes, Paul Ehrlich, Mr. Pompous Predictor with absolute certainty of absurd outcomes, claiming hundreds of millions of people are going to die of starvation and we're running out of everything, made the stupid, stupid mistake of accepting Julian Simon's sucker bet, where Julian Simon said, look, bet me about the prices of any natural resource that you like over any period longer than a few years, and we'll take that bet and we'll see who wins. And Paul Ehrlich took the bet and he wound up losing. He got a basket of goods that was worth $1,000 around 1980. 1990, the price of that basket was about $500, so he owed Julian Simon $500. And notice that's not adjusted for inflation, so actually Julian Simon won even better than he might have seemed. And then, what did Paul Ehrlich say about this? He said, well, bets don't prove anything, first of all, and I only did it in order to show people that Simon was wrong. Wait a second. But if you winning would have showed he was wrong, isn't your losing something that tends to show that he's right? All right, so nevertheless, yes, so betting markets are wonderful, and anytime there is a question, betting markets are precisely what we should turn to. And if you think the betting markets are wrong, you don't need to talk, you can just put your money up.
Yes.
That they are a bad. Yeah, betting markets are the best aggregator of information that we have. Now, there are still some problems within betting markets. You may notice that, for example, if you trade on Intrade, that Hillary, last time I checked, was still 4% chance of winning. I don't think that's 4% chance of her winning at this point. I think it's quite a bit less. However, if I were to go and try to bet on my belief, you know, I think it's pretty close to zero. So you might think that I could go and make some free money by betting against Hillary and Intrade. However, that's not really true, because Intrade requires that I first go and send them an upfront cash payment, and they don't pay interest on the account. So basically, even if I knew for sure that it was zero, it turns out I would not really wind up making much money on that because of the transaction costs. Although once the market got to be as big as the U.S. stock market, then you would probably be able to trade for basically no transaction fee, and then the markets would be even more reliable than they are right now. Let's see, yes, right there, yep. Alex. Can you speak up?
Are there any systematic differences between feedback from political scientists
So any systematic
differences
so between how the two groups respond? Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, how do economists like your treatment of survey data?
Okay, so two good questions. So I don't have any, I have no like actual form, formal data on how economists versus political scientists reacted. What I will say is, I think political scientists overall were friendlier. Right? And I think a lot of this actually is just that I made a real effort to actually read what political scientists had to say, and when they had something good to say, I gave them credit, which is something that economists are not very good at. Okay? So when economists imperialize a field, normally they just come in and like burn everything here, and we will now tell you how things are. So people tend to resent that. So political scientists have actually been extremely friendly towards me, which I thought was very nice of them. Economists, again, I think there's a very big divide between people who are like high theory people who just say, what you're saying is impossible, it's ridiculous. And and this doesn't lead anywhere. Mainly, it would lead to questioning whether democratic outcomes work, right? So on the other end, there's a lot of people who have been very friendly. And so Greg Mankiw, in one of my great triumphs, calls himself a Kaplanian. So when I was an undergraduate, when I heard about him, the idea that he would one day call himself a Kaplanian on his blog, I'm like, oh wow, the wonderful Mankiw calls himself a Kaplanian. It's so great. So yes. So your second question was, how do economists react to my use of survey data? Well, it turns out that I came into economics at a great time, because when I started graduate school, there was still basically this methodological injunction against economists looking at survey data. And somehow during the time that I started graduate school and during the time that I started research, this injunction basically disappeared. Virtually no economist cares anymore about whether you use survey data. They may have specific complaints about maybe the question isn't well worded, but no longer will virtually any economist at any major school or any referee report just say, but surveys are just about what people say, whereas economics is about what people do. Right? And it's a good thing that they stopped saying that, because where do we get unemployment data, for example? We do get it by calling up someone and asking them, did you work last week? So really, it's not the unemployment rate, it's the reported unemployment rate. It's the unemployment rate that people said they had. And similarly, where do inflation numbers come from? Surely those come from the actual numbers. No, what happens is that the government has a bunch of bureaucrats who are official shoppers. Their job is to go to stores and buy a basket of goods or look at what the prices are and then report them. And then what they do, they go back and they say what the prices are, and we believe them. Okay, so actually all economic data is based upon what people say. So there's nothing particularly bad about survey data in that respect. Again, you can always complain that there are some problems in data. There's always problems with data. So the question is, do you have any specific complaint that can actually be improved upon or not? Now, incidentally, this is actually somewhere where Milton Friedman appears to be entirely to blame for 50 years of economists ignoring survey data. So in Methodology of Positive Economics, he actually gave a bunch of horrible arguments about why economists should never use survey data. You can go and read them and be underwhelmed. They really are at the level of saying, they could be lying. We can't be absolutely sure that survey responses are honest. That's why we should rely upon other numbers, where we can be absolutely sure, right? Never, he didn't say that. I think you would have realized how ridiculous that was. But the standard of absolute certainty is a crazy one to hold for any applied work. See other questions? I'll see in the back. I'm very glad that you brought that up. So I didn't talk very much about special interests. Among economists, the usual thing they do whenever they find a policy that is against the public interest is they find a special interest group and they point the finger at them. They say, "Look, this policy is clearly caused by the dog catchers because this benefits dog catchers." Well, I mean, it's an interesting story. It's one that a lot of economists hold. However, my point is that before you start pointing fingers at special interests, it would behoove you to take a look at public opinion data. Social Security is a great example. Is it really true that the only people who support Social Security are retirees or people who are close to retirement age? No. It is absolutely false. Turns out that Social Security enjoys the overwhelming support of Americans of every age group. In fact, if anything, the elderly are a little bit less supportive of Social Security than the younger people. It's something like 83% of the elderly support it, 85% of the non-elderly support it. And the same goes for a long list of policies that economists usually blame on special interests. It is true for farm subsidies. It's true for protectionism. Now, I'm not saying that special interests don't make any difference, but I think the difference they make is very different from what most economists think. What special interests do is not come up with some policy that is abhorrent to the American people and then ram it down their throats. Instead, what they do is they find out, what would the American people accept? Interesting. And then, out of the list of what the American people accept, then they go and lobby for something that's beneficial for them. So the fact that we have a steel tariff, that is actually caused by the fact that the steel industry lobbied for a steel tariff. However, the only reason this works at all is that when the American public hears that the steel industry wants a tariff, they don't say, "That's ridiculous. Free trade is the only good policy." Instead, they hear, "Oh my God, the steel industry's in trouble. We got to help them." And this is why when the president goes and imposes a steel tariff, he doesn't sign it in the middle of the night and then go on vacation. Instead, what he does is he has a big press conference where he's with steel workers and the steel industry and a bunch of other politicians who all supported it, and they say, "We're doing something for the American steel worker." And they try to get it on the news. So why do they want everybody to know they're doing this? Because most people think this is a great idea. Most people think this is wonderful. So in general, I think that economists have been very quick to blame special interests for everything wrong in the world, never going and taking a look and seeing, is this policy popular in the first place? Again, sort of like the last thing people may say is, well, the special interest caused it to be popular. I think if you look at the budget of most special interest groups, this is very hard to believe. Because they have like a few million dollars to spend every year, and somehow a few million dollars is supposed to like make everyone completely support whatever it is they think. This wouldn't work for toothpaste. Toothpaste, you got to keep spending tons of money every single year to keep people brushing your teeth with your stuff. And yet, the farm lobby, how much money are they really spending on molding public opinion every year? I think much more of it is just about... they're saying something that fits with what people naturally believe, like, we got to make sure that these evil people on the market don't deprive us of food. Okay, so I guess we have maybe time for one more question. Yes, in the back. So yes, in the next 10 seconds, I'll explain it. So first thing, it's very worth saying, any theory that says that it is easy to greatly change the world is false. Okay, so anyone who says, well, all you need to do is go home, shoot an email to your congressman, everything will be fine. All theories of that form are definitely false. So we're saying that. Now, assuming my theory is one of a family of reasonable theories, all of which say that changing the world for good in a substantial way will be difficult. Okay, so that's true, and you just have to live with it. Now, what can actually be done? Well, step one, I believe, is just getting the public to admit that it has a problem. It's like Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to get people to come up and say, "Hello, I'm a voter and I'm irrational." All right, now you don't really need to get any individual to do this. What you need to do is get a lot of people saying, "Those guys are voters, they're irrational, and they got a problem." And if this becomes conventional wisdom, I think this would do a great deal of good just to get rid of this absurd presumption that if the American people wants X, X is good. Just if you could make people laugh whenever a politician says, "The American people believes that," and then people start laughing hysterically. if we could get to the point of having people laugh at all sentences beginning with "the American people want something," that would be great progress. So that's step one, just getting people to admit there's a problem. Another very big step is education, which I'm happy to be at the Foundation for Economic Education, which has spent decades trying to raise the public's level of understanding with some success. Right, so people who are older than me can say, 30 years ago, the number of people at these seminars was like three guys, right? And they weren't actually here. They were like calling from a payphone three states away saying, "We're going to be here. We're on our way. And we want to get some economic education." So things have greatly improved. A great deal of progress is made. If you read Brian Doherty's book, Radicals for Capitalism, you can really see how free market ideas went from being something believed by like three people left alive to thousands and thousands of influential people. And if you say, but we haven't succeeded yet, well, that's a very negative view of things. You'll say, look, the glass is not entirely full. The glass is like 1/20th full. Well, at least it's not empty, right? We've made that progress. So education and economics and liberty has made enormous strides over the decades. We've made a lot of progress, and if we just keep growing at something like the rate we've been growing, then by 2000, by the year 2200, libertopia will be ours. Okay, so so you may say, well, what constellation is that? Well, here's another constellation. You can, the fact that you don't live in an entirely free society does not prevent you from having a very enjoyable life. Right? So you may think, do I get depressed when I sit around studying public opinion? Yeah, a little bit, but I look around and say, you know what? I have all these friends. I have these great lunches with them, and I have a dream job for life where I talk about ideas with all my friends, and there's this blogosphere. I can blog my ideas, and people listen to me somehow. Not millions of people, but thousands of people listen to me. That's like my entire high school. when I was in high school, if I could have been the one kid that everybody listened to, that would have been so great. Now, I have that, although they're spread out over the world, but the readers are much higher quality than the kids who went to high school with me, so it's really better. It's really much better. Now, in terms of other things you can do, there are many institutional changes that could be suggested and which I believe would improve things if tried. However, there is a catch-22. Namely, you have to first convince the majority to stop having majority rule about something. And that's really hard, right? So it is true, we have a lot of areas right now where the majority doesn't have a say. So we don't currently vote on freedom of speech. We don't currently vote on freedom of religion. If you read the second to last page of Atlas Shrugged, she has a new constitutional amendment. Congress will pass no law abridging the freedom of production and trade. If we could go and get that amendment on the books, that would be a big improvement. However, I don't think that's very likely. In fact, I think we'd be much more likely to persuade people to directly support more free market policies than to get that amendment down, because people know what that amendment is going to do. Right? So they will see through it. If they think that policy is bad, then getting an amendment is not going to be any help. And in general, this is true for most other institutional fixes. So one thing I haven't mentioned, but which is worth saying, is that in general, again, you may find this hard to believe, but in general, more educated people think more like economists and have more libertarian views. If you say, but I go to school with a lot of highly educated people who aren't libertarians. Listen to what I said. More libertarian. And they think more like economists. If you think that they're not libertarian, don't think like economists, go and talk to high school dropouts, and you will find what people who really don't think like economists and really are anti-liberty think. Okay, so, all right. Now, the other thing, of course, is that people who hang around in universities are highly educated people who don't like the market very much. Okay, so they are not a random sample of highly educated people. So once you realize that more educated people in general do have more sensible views, then you may think, so maybe we could give 2 votes to college graduates. I think that would do a great deal of good. And this was actually on the books in England as recently as 1949, we're saying. I don't think this is going to happen. I think it would improve things if happened, but not very likely. But still, it's worth pointing out just for the shock value. Just to say, look, you think that education is important, right? Right? And education makes people better voters, right? Well, then why not just give 2 votes to educated people and watch the magic happen? It is worth saying just to see the look on their faces, but moreover, what I'm saying is true. If more educated people were to vote more, your policy would improve. Think about it this way. If you right now watch presidential debates and think that it's just a bunch of demagoguery, imagine how bad it would be if everybody voted. Right? Because right now, more educated people are more likely to vote. So the demagoguery that you see is not the demagoguery that would actually be given if everyone were actually voting. It would be worse. It may seem hard to believe, but no, it could get worse, definitely. So let's see, I think I'm out of time, but if you would like to talk to me at the bar tonight, I'm more than happy to take any further questions then.